Hey everyone, welcome back to the fire. I'm Kylie Payne, and in today's episode, I get to talk with the witty and charismatic Nat Yonts. I first met Nat through my good old friend Alex Norman. Back in high school, Alex bridged a couple different groups with our Oak Mountain crew. That's how I met folks from Spain Park and Vestavia Hills. At least that's how I remember it. Nat has gone on to study in Dublin for a few years and returned with a degree in audio engineering. He writes and records his own music and has produced a couple of radio dramas. I even heard that he's had the opportunity to work with Sylvester McCoy, who, if you don't know, played the seventh incarnation of the Doctor on Doctor Who. So that's pretty awesome, if you ask me. Nat's currently living in Chattanooga, Tennessee, doing what most of us young creative types are trying to do, namely, stay afloat and make a few waves at the same time. Once again, I'm so glad I started and have continued to stay with this project. I get to have some truly inspiring conversations with people I might not have the chance to converse with otherwise. I tend to compromise my social life in order to make time for other priorities. That's not to say that I don't value friendship, I just can't afford to be as social as I'd like to be. I deny the philosophy that time is money, but still I find myself having little of either. So this is the first podcast that I've recorded using the Google Hangouts, so it might sound a little bit different. Not saying it's going to be better or worse than what you're used to, but yeah, might sound a little bit different is all. Okay, so in this conversation you're about to hear, we do a bit of catching up and talking about where we've been, what we've done, as well as what we'd like to do and where we'd like to go. Talk a little bit of shop, covering some of the nuances of our respective fields. And towards the end, we get around to a subject I was really hoping I'd get to talk with Nat about. If you've been paying attention to the news over the past couple months, then you've probably noticed there's a lot of change going on lately, at least symbolic change, change in the form of the symbols we're choosing to put out publicly to represent ourselves. The South is steeped in its own symbology, and all this heritage that we hear so much about, these antiquated antebellum ideals. So in light of recent events, there's been a public outcry against these symbols, and some folks are saying that this is the politically correct crowd pushing a revisionist version of history. Now, I don't really buy that line. The so-called rebel flag, which was really just a battle standard for some of the forces that fought in the Civil War, that flag was not resurrected until the 60s, during the height of the Civil Rights Movement, at just about the same time we started to find In God We Trust on all of our money. That to me is the real revisionist history. If you look back at first-hand documents produced during the 1850s and 1860s, the Civil War was totally over states' rights. The states' rights to own slaves, that is. Slavery is mentioned more often than any other reason for seceding the Union in the Articles of Succession issued by all the states that chose to secede. Never forget that war has always been fought by the poor. Both sides of that conflict used conscription to fill out their ranks. And it was common practice that if you had the money, you could buy your way out of conscription, or you could hire somebody to fight instead of you. Now, this was not an option for most people. Most people could not afford to take that route. And, not so Most people did not want to fight and die in a war that they didn't feel that they would benefit or gain anything from. There were actually even counties in every state that succeeded, or most every state that succeeded. There were counties within those states that seceded from the secession, meaning that they chose to either, you know, like remain a part of the Union or just withdraw entirely from both sides of the conflict. In Alabama, there was what was known as the Republic of Winston, now known as Winston County. Draft dodgers and abolitionists alike congregated in Winston to solidify their resistance to what they saw as an immoral and unjust war. Now, if you look at Winston County today, the per capita income is only $18,000 and $18,055. Like, that's below poverty. 15.4% of the population, and 20% of families in that county live below the poverty line. So I would argue that, you know, because of this position that they took during that time, that the state has not forgotten and has continued to frown upon them for acting that way, where you're not towing the party line, as it were. But I'm going off on a bit of a tangent, so I'm going to bring it back now. In high school, Nat was the mascot. He, you know, would don the outfit and would get out in front of the crowd during pep rallies and football games. Now, the Vestavia Hills mascot is the Vestavia Hills Rebels, and the figure itself is known as the Rebel Man. And if you look at a picture of the Rebel Man, he is a very stereotypical old white Southern gentry. This image that they've chosen is exclusionary, you know, it excludes many of the students or people in that area, and it's not reflective of today's values or ideals. So Nat tells us a little bit about, like, what it was like, what his experience was in, you know, playing as the Rebel Man, and he also tells us a bit about what happened when there was a push to change that image, and he spoke out on the side of saying that this is something that we need to change, and that him having been the Rebel Man has a, I guess, like, certain right to speak to that. And so, yeah, he shares with us his experiences in trying to share that view with the, you know, people in that community. So, yeah, been going on for a little bit of a while by myself, so I'm going to cut on over to the episode. I hope you enjoy. Be sure to check out the show notes and check out Nat's stuff on SoundCloud, because it's really good, and yeah, I think you'd like it. So, see you on the other side.
Everything is falling down. I'm going to swap to headphones since we're not on camera.
Sure.
Awesome. All right, say something.
Test, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Excellent. That's perfect. Cool beans, man. So before we get started, tell me, when did you start this podcast? Like, what's the deal?
It actually started probably about 2 years ago, and I hadn't been doing it consistently. Like, I started out, you know, just like in a little burst here and there, and then when Monolith Radio got going, I saw that as like an avenue to you know, get more serious about doing this. And so I've been trying to do, more frequent episodes and been able to stick with this like episode every other week for a couple months now. So
that's pretty cool, man. I'm glad that you've done this. It seems really neat.
Yeah, I've enjoyed doing it and getting out and, it's an excuse to be social. So I always need something like that going on.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that for sure. I've been stuck up here in Chattanooga just living with my folks, which is I love my parents. They're great. But it gets a little lonely just living at home for 8 months.
Yeah, that's understandable. I wasn't aware that you were up in Chattanooga.
Yeah, I've been here since, I was in Dublin for about 3 years, and then the money ran out over there. And so I came, my parents moved up here away from Vestavia, literally like a month before I moved to Dublin a few years ago. So like for a while I felt, essentially like spiritually homeless,
Right.
No friends there and no real home to come back here to. So that's where I am now. It's just living up here. I mean, we have a cool house. It's nice. My parents have saved up some money and now they're both retired. They're kind of trying to live the good life and I'm just kind of riding their coattails at the moment.
Right. Yeah, my parents are getting close to that. And my dad's taking like a little bit of his retirement money and like fixing up like this foreclosed house. And so that's like where me and my partner, Kelly, we're about to be moving into and paying him rent. And so that'll put me like further from Birmingham, which I don't like, but it'll get me closer to school. And then also like I'm going to have like a lot of space and like studio room. So really looking forward to that.
That'll be awesome. Where did you say you're going to school again?
I'm at Montevallo. Seems like for a while. I think I've got about a year left in front of me and then I'll finally be out with a BFA in photography.
Cool. That stuff's awesome. My dad's trying to get into photography right now. I'm going to buy him, actually, it's a surprise, I'm going to buy him a book on, how to take photographs, well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Last episode I recorded with Andy Harris of the Old Paints, was out at Birmingham, or not Birmingham, Railroad Park, and got there early so that I could just go around and get some pictures and ended up bumping into a guy named Charles Walton, who's a well-known artist in Birmingham and gave a quick critique on what I was doing and gave me several tips on how to compose street photography, or street portraits. And so that was an awesome, totally wasn't expecting to meet somebody like that on the street like that. But it was just very fortunate occurrence.
Yeah, man. Those moments are just the best, right?
Oh, yeah. And it's just, one of the benefits I've found of investing time and into this project and working and getting to know people. Because, yeah, it's like you benefit a lot from networking with folks.
Yeah, that's actually, I'm glad you mentioned that. I'm actually, I'm leaving for Pittsburgh tomorrow, actually, for 5 days, where I'm going to, essentially an unpaid job, but it's a networking opportunity. And dude, I'm getting pretty damn sick of unpaid networking opportunities, but you gotta do them.
That's funny. There's the last episode with Andy Harris, he performed a song called The Exposure Will Be Great, and talking about when you go out and you have to do something just to get the exposure.
Yeah, I think we should all just start pretending we've been charging people for things.
Yeah, part of the, faking it till you make it.
Yeah.
Sort of scheme.
Act like, I mean, obviously, if you're out there putting yourself out there, you think you're good, so why not act like it?
Yeah, and I think I have been doing that to a degree, and it's it works. You just have to believe in yourself and work at what you're doing, and people eventually start to notice that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I wonder if it's and I don't mean this in any disparaging way. It's just by the nature of the medium. I wonder if it's like easier for photographers to fake it because you guys already have the good photographs for like a Facebook profile picture or something for like, you know, a fan page or something like that. Whereas like somebody who's a musician or, I don't know, let's see, I don't know, like a sound designer or something like that has to have a portfolio that can't be readily accessed at a glance, you know?
That's true. Yeah, because yeah, visually there's that, you know, instantaneous, like you see it and you know, you're seeing it, but yeah, with like something that you hear, you don't automatically recognize that as a, you know, something unique and individual.
Yeah, and we don't have the skills that you guys have. Like, we have to pay you guys to give us that kind of exposure that you can do for yourself, you know?
Right.
I guess is what I essentially meant.
Yeah, like a photographer has their own, like, there's a self-promoting business.
Yeah. Like, you can go ahead and make your own album cover, essentially.
Yeah, that's true. And, like, I guess there's varying degrees or levels, like, because, I mean, a lot of people can get their hands on the equipment and, you know, start taking images. But, like, I guess it's always, well, you know, I guess, like, you know, to somebody in my position who's trained to a degree to be able to critique, you know, visual arts or photography, like, you know, I'll look at something and be like, oh, like, I can see things in this that, like, you know, I'm you know, obviously they weren't aware of. And so, like, I guess to, like, a degree, like, it's sort of, like, I feel like I get stuck in, like, a critiquing mode sometimes, and yeah. I'm critiquing more. But I feel like that may be true of a lot of people who work in, like, a creative industry or something where they're, yeah, creating content.
Yeah, I totally know what you mean, too. Like, it is frustrating, you know, having gone the academic route. And then seeing people who have not, and, you know, I want everybody to succeed, because if everybody succeeds, that means there's just more for us to consume.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a bit frustrating when you see people who believe they are succeeding and clearly don't have the technical knowledge or the exposure to, say, more out there artistic endeavors like you get through colleges and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, I would not have any idea about the strange, weird music that's out there had I not gone to Birmingham Southern, yeah. You know? And I probably would have formed incorrect opinions about it had I heard it. Sorry, I'm trying to get my computer charged.
Sure.
Had I heard it outside of a college classroom setting. Because it's just noise. It's weird shit, you know? I needed somebody to explain it to me, and I feel like there are all these people out there who, and it's unfortunate, are not getting that kind of exposure. And I feel that's very limiting. Like, I truly believe that you can teach yourself how to do something, but it's very hard to teach yourself how to appreciate something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm kind of rambling because I was distracted trying to fix, my computer was about to die.
Oh no, it's cool. Like rambling's perfectly fine. That I think rambling suits the podcast format quite well. But anyways, like I guess like going back to like what you're saying earlier, like I think you know all creative mediums have their own, I guess, sets of pitfalls. Like I guess I don't know how like the sound engineer Mark can get it. Market is, but like I feel like with photography it's a like that's a very crowded market. Like there's a lot of people who do like you know like wedding photography, newly born baby photography, you know, all that sort of stuff. Like there's all these niches that like people are you know into. Like, and I'm currently working for like a little local outfit doing like sports little league sports portraits.
That's awesome, though. That sounds like it'd be a really fun job.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoy it. Like, I'm glad I was able to get in on this, and just like the I guess like the experience of like learning how to direct and interact with the kids like that. Like, I mean, I view that as very knowledgeable or you know valuable knowledge and experience that I'm gaining. So I always try to like look at, and then like the other job I'm working right now is like at this, it's like a, you know, a cashier and a like stocking stuff at a pet store. And like, I haven't had to work a job like that since like my very first job back when I was 16. So I haven't had to deal with the public a whole lot. And so I feel like I've benefited from having to do that. Just like having to, you know, be forced to like walk up and interact with complete strangers and just like strike up conversations. Like that's good for me.
I know exactly what you mean. I'm in essentially the same position since I'm working at a burrito shop here in Chattanooga. Like today I was just like, I am the cashier as well. I used to, when we had our previous location, it was a really tiny hole in the wall burrito joint. And I mean, we get, you know, lunch rushes and stuff, but it was so small that it was sort of like that Yogi Berra joke. Nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded. Mm-hmm. So it never got overwhelming, but, it was just three or four of us in the whole shop just working there. And we'd swap off like who would roll the burritos, who would put the cold food or the hot food on, or who would work the cash register. And then we made a lot of money, and we not me, the company made a lot of money. Obviously, I barely saw a cent of that. But we moved to a new, bigger location, and now it feels like a real restaurant. And I literally am scheduled to work just cashier all day long, and it's fine because I enjoy talking to people and I enjoy seeing and interacting with, quite frankly, a huge variety of very strange human beings. But you know, it's that thing you were saying where you're just thrown into the fire of having to interact.
Right.
And I've never really worked at a job where I've had to talk to so many people that I don't want to say like so many people that I don't care about, but that's the cynical part of it. Like, I do care about them, and I enjoy seeing them and interacting with them on a less than personal level. But it's weird for me because this is the first time I've ever had to interact with so many people on a less than personal level, you know?
Yeah. And I definitely understand where you're coming from with like saying like the less than personal. Cause yeah, it's like, I mean, the circumstances are, it's like, you know, it's like you're being paid to be here and do this, but like, you know, you still want to make it a pleasant experience for both you and the other person. It's like, you know, I don't think, you know, most people that I deal with, they aren't assholes. Like they're people who, like, you know, I can tell like maybe they've like, you know, been frustrated or you know, had like something going on. And so like, you know, if I see that, you know, I back off and, you know, I don't try to engage in a conversation, but you know, if they, you know, ask me like where something is, then I'm going to like, you know, start up and give, I guess, you know, a bit of like the spiel that I got to give as far as like, you know, products are concerned, but then also like, you know, just talk because yeah, like you got somebody there that you're talking to and it's like, I guess and at some level it is, I feel like so personal because that's like, you know, two humans when you're confined or engaged in a space together, like that's the natural thing to do is just like sort of small talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally get that. Yeah. Do you like Star Trek?
Yeah, actually, the funny thing about that, like, okay, so growing up, I had like two friends, childhood friends that like really enjoyed the show and like watched it like as soon as it came on, like that's like they stopped what they were doing and they went to watch Star Trek, and that's when I would go home. Because, like when I was a kid, I did not have the attention span to make it through those opening credits. Like there's so many TV shows that like I know their opening credits and then that's it, because like I just couldn't watch it after that. But I have recently in the past few months started watching The Next Generation, and yeah, like really enjoying it.
It's great, isn't it?
Like, you know, like I guess, you know, really got into Doctor Who a couple years ago, and then like that's sort of like, you know, I've caught up on all that, and now like I feel like this is the next like show that I can settle into for a while and really enjoy it.
Yeah, I understand. Have you seen the episode where Data learns small talk?
Uh, I'm not sure. I know, like, there's one where he was, like, trying to learn, like, how to tell jokes.
Yeah, yeah. There's one where he, like, meets the, like, Jerry Lewis avatar or whatever.
Yeah.
No, there's the one where they're stationed at some ceremony or some little party for some admiral that is known for his small talk. And while everybody else is on the planet, Picard goes back up to get his saddle because he hears there's good horseback riding because it's Picard, whatever. And while he's there, some people who are posing as technicians are trying to steal the Enterprise. But it's really funny because in between these scenes of great stress and tension where Picard is like hiding from these horrible hijackers, you know, Data and this admiral are engaged. Like, Data's obviously a robot who can continue this forever. And this man is just a boring human being who can also continue this forever. It's great. It's a wonderful episode. It's very, very funny. But I feel like I'm at once both of those characters when I'm engaging with people in small talk.
Yeah, I could see that.
But it's funny because that makes me feel better because I like Star Trek so much. So I'm like, okay, I'm just being Star Trek. Yeah. That's how I deal with my days. Just pretend I'm in Star Trek.
And I guess I've been really impressed, I guess, just like by the cast of that show. Yeah, just like or like Brent Spiner, like, you know, the actor that plays Data, like,
yeah,
it's like the because like when he when he's Data, it's like it's so thoroughly convinced that like he is an android, and then the fact that he, you know, plays multiple characters throughout the show, and then like I don't suspect that, like, you know, character of being like the same actor, like, yeah, that's truly good acting.
Yeah, it's like it's weird that they look the same, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I totally get where you're coming from. That's, I mean, it's a great damn show. It's a great damn show. I tried to when I was in Dublin, I was living with a guy named Dave Rudden, who you are going to hear about in 2016 because he's just signed a more than half a million euro contract for publishing his young adult novels.
Oh,
he's got a trilogy that. They're called The Borrowed Dark in Ireland and England, and I forget what his American title is. I think it's Denizen Hardwick and the Knights of Borrowed Darkness or something like that.
Hmm.
Anyway, he's a huge science fiction fantasy buff since he's writing, you know, sci-fi YA novels. He loves Star Trek, but I never got the feeling that he was really a Trekkie. He was always more into comic books and stuff like that. But I showed him that episode that we were talking about with the small talk, and he just thought that was the funniest thing. And because he's a man who can just talk about anything to anyone. And obviously, like, there's something going for him since I think he set a record or something for being the youngest author to be published so quickly or something like that. He was, wow. I mean, he got an agent and was published in 2 weeks.
Huh.
Yeah, it was nuts. But and I read the first page of his manuscript, and it was incredible. But he has this ability to tell stories that is just incredible because he can talk about something that you don't care about, and you finally, you know, you suddenly find yourself caring about it. And it could be something like Game of Thrones or feminism, you know?
Yeah.
A great orator.
And like that's like I guess like that the trademark of a great storyteller is it's like it's not even what they're saying, it's the way that they're saying it that draws you in. It's, I guess, something about like the cadence of how they're phrasing things and connecting it all together.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it really is. I mean, there's just something to the presentation, right?
Like, I don't know. In one of the like the photography class that I have this semester, the professor is you know, like, critiquing some of our images and looking at stuff and, like, I guess trying to attach a philosophy behind like our projects and what we're doing. And so, like, recently she gave us this like list of, like, you know, things that have been said by great photographers, and one of them is like, it's like each image, like, only needs to tell, like, or only needs to have like one narrative in it, like, those, I guess, like there's a lot of work that we were showing that was like too busy or like having like multiple like things of interest going on, but like a good narrative, I guess, like doesn't have too much distracting elements, or just like we are essentially just like to focus on telling your one story and let all those other things fall aside.
You know, you're the second person that I've heard that from. I don't know anything about visual art at all. It's not how my brain works. It's just, and I've tried, and like, I mean, my handwriting is terrible no matter the amount of practice that I've put into it. I can't draw for shit. I've had to make videos for school, and I was able to lie my way through them to a good grade because we had to make reports about them too. But, or a decent grade, I should say. I didn't fail. But I was just recently working on a video shoot with a company here in Chattanooga at the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Tennessee. Oh. And it was so dry. We were just filming a video that is informational that they're sending out to all the companies that give Blue Cross Blue Shield to their employees. And it's about like an app they can download and a new, service they can apply for that I didn't, obviously give a shit about. But I was with this video company and we were just kind of on our break. We were just talking about video and the philosophy of filmmaking in general, or not necessarily filmmaking as like, an art form, I suppose, more the utilitarian sense of, we're trying to convey what we've been paid to convey, which I think in and of itself has its own merits. But we were talking about that, and they mentioned the focus that you were just talking about, the one thing at a time.
Uh-huh.
I forget exactly how he said it, but the guy who was the director said, there can be many things in the photo, but only one thing conveyed, or something like that.
Right.
It was something along those lines. I don't remember. But I really like that idea. I think it can be applied to music as well. And I think that's something that I've been struggling with as a composer. It takes balls to make your music simple. Not like simplistic, like children's music or anything, but like to make it pared down and focused. I think people get scared. And I do this all the time. Like, this is literally like how I operate, is I get scared and I put too much into my music. And then I have to spend the next like 3 weeks taking 90% of it away when I'm composing. And I don't know. Do you feel that way when you're doing your photography work?
I feel like I have certainly found myself, like working into that situation or like going into like if there's something that just like, I guess like, isn't working, or like I want it to work a whole lot, and so I keep working on it, and then it just becomes overworked. And at some point I was like, yeah, like I need to go like find like 2-3 revisions ago and like go back and look at that, because like whatever I've done is just like, it's, yeah, I got either the colors have just gone too wild, like, because yeah, sometimes I'll look at like the original, like what the tonality of the images, and I look at then what I've done to it, and it just like looks so unreal at that point that it's like I don't like it anymore, or I don't know, yeah, like I'll just be like trying new processes or whatever, just trying to do stuff, and then yeah, like certainly I feel like that's probably something that again, like most creative industries or fields would experience.
Yeah, I think it's a lack of confidence, quite honest. Lack of confidence in your own work.
Yeah, and then yeah, going back to like not knowing what that narrative, what the story is that you're trying to tell, and so you don't know what's important to focus on.
Yeah, exactly. It's okay. So when you're editing your photographs, do you feel like it's beneficial to, I don't know, say take a 20-minute break and go do something else and then come back and reevaluate what you've done?
Oh yeah. I typically I'll come in and like if it's a good day, then like I'll come right in from a shoot, put my images on the computer, and then just like pull it up, and then like find all like images that I can sort of like batch process. And so like I can just,
what does that mean? What is batch processing?
So it's like if I take like 20 pictures set up in the same setting, like not moving my camera any more than like 5 or 10 feet, and so like the lighting is going to be essentially like the same, then I can take all those 20 images and edit them at the same time. Like I can apply the same color filters and the same, like adjusting the contrast and that sort of stuff. And then I'll go through and I'll just like sort of like batch process images and in groups like that, and then take a break, and then next session I'll come in and look at those and individually play with the levels and try to bring them to what I think is like, you know, personally best for that particular image.
I wanted to say one thing to that, you know, but then I had another question that was like really burning. Okay. First, you know, sound engineers literally have to take breaks like that because our ears get tired and like we stop hearing essentially. And we only think we're hearing, but literally the hairs in our ears are not falling down like they're supposed to. So they're not sending the signals to the nerves.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's frustrating as fuck too, because like I just want to keep working because it's something I love doing, but I actually like I physically have to stop and go like make tea, or what I really do is I stop, I go downstairs, I take a swig of whiskey, and I just go read, and then I come back.
Huh.
But
that you said after 20 minutes that begins to happen.
No. You're supposed to take a break for like 20 minutes.
Okay.
You can. I mean, it's different. For different people, how long it takes for that to start happening. For me, I have particularly bad hearing. I have to be very careful when I'm mixing, not to be too loud because I don't want to damage it any further. But people develop a feel and a taste for things. So even though like my sensitivity is not as great as it should be, as it could be, I still know how to listen to things. I still know what to listen for.
Right.
But what I wanted to ask was, you mentioned, you know, bringing up the levels to what you think is best personally. And I don't know anything about photography at all. And you mean color levels, right? Like warmth and hue and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I don't know what either of those words mean. I'm just throwing them out because I've heard them before.
Right.
And what do you use to gauge what's good and what's not?
That's sort of weird. Like some of it is very like intuitive. Just like I've been told from like doing some of these art crawls, and like I have an absolute inability to like pick and choose like specific works to bring out to these. So I end up usually hauling out everything and then just like displaying what I can. And then if somebody shows interest, then I'll just like bring out more stuff for them to look at. But from people looking at my work, like I've been told that like I have like a very consistent like choice of like color or like a palette throughout my works that's like not conscientious or intentional on my behalf. Like it's just like that's I guess like my natural inclination is to work in these certain tonalities or you know color patterns, and you know other people have pointed that out to me. A lot of it's intuitive, but then also it's like, you know, I open up an image in Photoshop and it displays like I see like a graph that shows a range from you know black, gray, white, and then I can like and it's like a graph with a line starting at like 0, 0 and then going like up and to the right, and you can add points on that line and shift and move it around, and that affects the brightness or darkness of those tones. So like if you take a point in the middle that would like represent like absolute gray and shift it all the way up, then that what was once like gray now becomes white, everything lighter than gray is white as well. And so like it just shifts and skews all the values. And then the same goes for each color channel.
Whoa, that's awesome. That like, sounds really cool.
The assignment that I'm working on currently is like trying to determine if we've got a good image from simply just looking at the histogram, which is that readout of those values. And so like being able to like look at that and then know that like you've got the perfect capture that like has like the full range of values. So because when you have like everything captured, that allows like, yeah, for much more simpler editing. You're not having to correct for things. It's always easier like to do it in capture than in post.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that's exactly the same principle in recording. Exactly. Like if you get a good source, the less mixing you can do, the less post you can do, the better the product will be.
Mm-hmm. And so yeah, like I feel like most of what I've done, it's like there's always something that like I work in Photoshop, and so like I've relied or I've come to rely on being able to like use Photoshop to correct anything that wasn't resolved in camera. And so like trying to get to that next level to where I'm not even having to rely on that editing too heavily. I could like just use it to enhance things rather than to doctor things.
Yeah, I understand. I know exactly what you mean. There's a lot of that. Like, I told you earlier, my dad's now into photography.
Right.
And he was talking to me about subtractive lighting. About, put as much light as you can on something and then take away from it to get what you want.
Right.
Which is essentially, how you're supposed to make music, which is, you select what kind of microphone you want, which is actually quite important in determining what sound you want, because microphones have different values on them and different, personalities, essentially.
Mm.
And then you have to figure out where to place it. And are you going to use multiple microphones? Really, you want to capture as many frequencies as you can, or if you're really, really good at it, you'll know where to put the microphone to capture more of the frequencies you want.
Mm.
And it's, I don't know, it's like, okay, so in music, so much is just, it just seems so counterintuitive. Like, when you want to pick up the high pitches in a guy or a girl's voice, you actually put the microphone nearer to their chest, which seems completely backwards because that's where, all the bass is resonating, is in the chest. But what's actually happening is that the high energy treble tones are bouncing off the roof of people's mouths down towards the microphone. So the treble is captured there. Or like you use a compressor to make things louder. You compress the sound waves so that they're quieter so that you can make them louder. Okay. It's very, very strange. And is it the same in photography? I don't know at all, but it just seems like if it is, they're both frustrating fields.
I feel like there's certainly a great deal in like knowing what is the correct equipment to use going into a different like or any given situation, because in all the photography gigs that I've done, like they've all been sort of like completely different forms of like photography. Like I said, I was doing the Little League sports portraits now, and then and so that's like setting up early in the morning and then like dealing with the weather conditions, but like we've got a flash, so having to like worry about like where the shadows are shooting out from the flash. And then before that I was doing like construction documentation, where again like I had like a flash, but like there was like a very specific way that every image needed to be like exposed and framed, and then I've done just like action photography or whatever, it's, you know, just like being on the, you know, sideline of a football field, like taking pictures as you know, things unfold, and there wasn't a flash there. But anyway, it's like, yeah, just like each situation sort of calls for its own set of like knowing, like, yeah, like what lens you want to have, and like, and then like the ISO, like, you know, like a low number ISO is going to be for like sunny day, whereas like a high number is for like nighttime. And there's like, my camera goes to like 1600 ISO, which like does decent like night photography, or I say decent because like I feel like I've been able to take images that way. But anyways, like there's cameras that are coming out now, like that have like ISOs that are like triple that, if not, you know, more, like they, you know, like you can point the camera up at the sky and get like wonderful, like, you know, pictures of the Milky Way, and that's like the sort of stuff, like when I see pictures of like stuff like that, like I get jealous, because like that's just like outside of the technical capacity of what my camera can shoot. Like I can get an image of the night sky like that, but it's so grainy that it just, you know, affects your ability to you know, see and enjoy the image. But yeah, like, so I feel like there's a lot of the confusion in photography would come from just the, yeah, like the amount of variables, because there's several different ways you can create a well-exposed image. And it just depends on, like, if you want to capture more of the light or more of the movement, or what combination of the two that you're trying to get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know what you mean. That's, I never thought about stuff like that. I think it's such a fascinating field that you're in. And I just don't have, you know, the sight for it, I guess.
And I feel like the same for you. Like I always have enjoyed listening to people, like, you know, like talk shop or whatever, like somebody who like knows like the ins and outs of something, and like knows somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Yeah. It's, I mean, yeah, it's great to be around, I suppose, experts. Not that either of us are really experts in our field yet, but we will be, I'm sure. But like, it is, especially when it's somebody that's in the same thing, you know, in the same field that you're interested in, and they know a lot more than you do. And they're particularly open to talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I love that sort of stuff.
Yeah, like I was saying, like when I was out at Railroad Park, like
you met Charles Walton,
like, yeah, just like totally out of the blue, but like he like, you know, what he said like stuck. Like he, and what he, you know, one of the things he said was like, whatever is closest to you, whatever's foregrounded, like that's going to become the focus of the image. So like if somebody has their hand extended out in front of their face, like you're not going to pay attention to their face anymore. You're going to be looking at their hand or whatever's in their hand. And, or, you know, the same goes for any like objects that end up getting in between you and your subject, like that's going to become the new focus. And so like, you know, you need to be very, like, I guess what I took away from that is being like much more conscientious of how I'm composing my images, and then, yeah, like going back to the whole, like trying to tell a single story with what I'm doing.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So like in telling like the single story, is there any particular thread that you want to really, I don't know, highlight in all of your podcasts?
Oh, like where it sort of like started out is, I guess, trying to have conversations about like stuff that's going on here in our region of the country, and I guess just sort of highlighting that there is a lot going on here, and that you know, like the social and cultural landscape of our region is in a flux right now, and there's all this potential for what the future can look like. And I guess just really wanting to like get people to recognize that and get in on shaping that.
Interesting. I didn't realize that was one of the, you know, tenets of this thing. Do you know, did you ever see what I did with the Vestavia Hills Rebel Man?
I remember seeing a couple posts, like back when you were saying that you were going to be speaking at the school, and that's actually like one of the subjects I was hoping we'd be able to talk about here.
Good. Yeah. I'd love to talk about that.
So I guess like give us a little bit of a setup and like so that people can know where you're coming from.
Well, I when I was a senior in high school, I was 18. My friend Reddick Davenport and I were friends with the two guys who had been the Rebel Man, the mascot, the previous year. And the whole thing, the whole setup is completely nepotistic, which is fine. It's high school. Who cares? The people who were the Rebel Men the year prior basically get to choose who gets to be the next in line. And so we were chosen because we were friends with those guys. And the Rebel Man, for people who don't know, is Vestavia Hills mascot. And it's not anymore. It was literally a Confederate. In print media, it was a Southern plantation owner. It was never really specifically said, but he was the same as Mississippi State's old, or maybe Ole Miss's, I don't remember which one, who cares, where it's just a Southern gentleman leaning on a cane with a big floppy hat. So essentially a racist landowner. What?
Does he have a cigar too? Or
I don't think ours did. I don't know about Mississippi's, but anyway, and that was the print media, and then the actual mascot costume was him in his uniform. Now, granted, it was a blue uniform, but nobody ever thought it was a Union soldier. I'll just go ahead and say that. I mean, anybody who brings that point up is grasping at straws. But anyway, so when we were 18, we're obviously not racists, but we didn't understand. And we totally picked up on the racist connotations of our ridiculous mascot. But to us, it was just a big joke. I mean, we didn't think Vestavia was taking it as a joke. We thought Vestavia was taking it seriously, which was to us very funny because of how ridiculous it was. Mm-hmm. And we didn't realize, understand at the time that it was insanely offensive to people. I guess we did understand that, but we never put two and two together. Like, hey, maybe that's actually not okay. Like, to us, it was just one big joke. We know we're not racists. You know, we know we don't care, but we didn't think about the people that it might be offending. That, you know, whose lives it might be affecting.
Right.
So we still, you know, we put the time in. We were the Rebel Men. We didn't give a shit about our school, but we pretended to because that was the job, you know. We got to go to Panama City Beach with the cheerleaders, which is way less fun than it sounds. And we put our time in, and then we left. And then, 2015 happened with this, massive social upheaval that we've been having. And John Archibald, the reporter for the Birmingham News, for Al.com, wrote an article entitled something like Vestavia Hills Mascot, A Smear Upon a Good City, or something like that. And I read the article, and I commented on the Facebook post, not on the Al.com article, but on the Facebook post of it, that I had been the mascot. I never thought, I was never a racist. I never thought that way. But now I realize that it's like simply not okay. And, I made a joke about it being like a shitty mascot anyway, because it's just an old man and he'll never stand up to like a tornado or a wild cat of some kind like other schools have.
Right.
And because of that comment, I was approached by another reporter named Lisa Borden. I think she's a reporter. I'm not exactly sure. We didn't have that much contact. But she put me in touch with a group called Advocates for Positive Change in Vestavia. And we talked a bit, and they were all speaking at this public forum in Vestavia about the mascot and about the name Rebels, particularly the mascot, because, you know, Rebels, there are plenty of non-racist Rebels in history.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I'd venture to guess that most of them are not racist. But I was with, you know, Ryan Nordness.
Oh, yeah.
I was with Ryan in Birmingham at the time of the forum, and we went over to Vestavia. It was the first time I've been back in Vestavia for quite a long time. We went to the Board of Education building, and we thought we were getting there early, right? We got there 45 to 30 minutes before the thing was supposed to start. There was a line around the building, and around well, it wasn't exactly the Board of Education building. It was some gathering place in Vestavia that was attached to one of the elementary schools. And the line snaked around the elementary school. It was absurd. Of supporters of the Rebel Man mascot, which in retrospect should not have surprised me because I grew up there and I realize how racist everybody is there, even though they're quote unquote not racist according to them.
Right.
But we got there and the thing was full. I tried to tell the security officers that I had been invited to speak, and I think that I made a mistake when I told one of them that I was on the side of change, which I should not have done. Ryan believes that the guy probably didn't take that into account, but I think it happened. I think that he did refuse me because what happened was they got to a capacity. I wasn't inside. One of the people who was from the advocates who wasn't speaking offered to give up her seat just after everyone had noticed that they were letting other substitutions happen.
Mm.
And now we don't know whose side those other substitutions were on, but I had already made my side, you know, known. And the police officer whom I had told that said, no, we're not letting anybody else in. Even though this woman said, I am giving up my seat for him. He said, no, we can't do that. So I wasn't allowed in. And we walked around to the back of the building where we'd heard there might be like a side entrance and we were not allowed in. But I had my speech prepared. I had it, you know, in my hand. And one of the women there with us said, well, would you like me to film it? And we can put it on YouTube. And so I said, yes. And we filmed it, and I put it on YouTube, and I sent it to John Archibald, just saying, like, hey, I don't expect you to do anything with this, but, you know, here's something that I did. Maybe you're interested at all. And he passed it on to some other writer, and they wrote an article about it. And I was, you know, it was my little 15 minutes of fame, which plenty of commentators or commenters on Al.com claimed was entirely my reasoning, you know, which was particularly frustrating. But, there were, you know, multiple death threats that got, deleted.
Wow.
And, you know, there was somebody saying, you know, I'll just come out and say it. He's a faggot.
Wow.
And like, you know, I've been called a faggot on the internet a lot, you know, it's the internet, but this one was actually quite personal. So it was weird. But it made me remember just how isolated and insular Birmingham suburbs can be. You know, it's this idea of, as Ryan put it, us versus them. And that's, I think that's a good point that he made. It is in their eyes very much an us versus them idea. But I think on a deeper level, it's that, you know, you and I saw on TV when we were little kids all those like 90s in pastel and crayon coloring commercials on TV that were all about, you know, diversity and acceptance and kids, like different colored kids in the classroom and stuff like that. And so we're like, oh yeah, yeah, that's fine, whatever. Racism is bad. And like all these kids that are our peers, our contemporaries who grew up in less accepting households are also taught that to some degree, but they're also taught that their views, which are racist, are not racist, because to be a racist is bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
So obviously what their parents are teaching them isn't racist because, it, you know, if it's not bad, so obviously it can't be racist. And now when something like the questioning of the Vestavia Hills mascot comes along, that's throwing their worldview askew. That's if the mascot gets taken down for being racist and they enjoyed and supported it in the past, that means that they themselves are racist. And that's what they can't handle. That's what they cannot accept, because it's so ingrained in us now that racism is bad. And I really think that's where all of this backlash has come from, is that we're not racist because we're not bad people, is their belief.
I feel like that's like so much of the narrative of like that's, you know, like US yeah, just like up till now is yeah, just like compounding things by the inability to accept the role that we've played in these events, and yeah, just like outright denial of what is either happening or has happened.
Yeah, I mean that's true. It is denial, and I really think that stems from the idea that they truly believe that they're not bad people, and only racists, or not only racists, but racists can only be bad people, so therefore they are not racist.
Mm-hmm.
Even though quite a lot of what they believe is racist. So they fight so vehemently to deny those accusations of being racist. And I really think that's where that comes from. And oh, yeah. I mean, these people fight tooth and nail for it. They really do. And, you know, Ryan put it the best. He said, you know, you're from the South. That means that you're supposed to be considerate. So when someone says, stop doing something that hurts my feelings, you should stop doing that because it hurts their feelings. You know, you don't go up to people and just be rude.
Uh-huh.
So why would you just go up to people and be racist? What I really wanted to do with my speech, what I really wanted to do, but I first of all, I didn't get to make it, but I didn't put this in. What I wanted to go up to these people and say was, look, I'm going to make this very, very simple. You feel good about something that makes other people feel bad. And some of you feel good that you feel good about something that makes other people feel bad. And do you know what that's called? That's called being a jerk. It's called being a bully. Like that's what is happening right now. And I mean, you know, somebody is suing Vestavia Hills. Did you know that about this?
No, I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, it just came out like last week or something like that. They're suing because of quote unquote the money being spent to repaint the gym. To get it's just, I mean, like, it's wankery is all it is. They're just jerking themselves off, trying to like come to terms with a world that isn't horrible.
Right. And like, I think you're like onto something where you're saying like, I guess like the whole, like, I guess like Southern idea of like, you know, you're supposed to like, you know, be considerate. And so like,
yeah, that I can't take credit for that. That was Ryan.
Okay. So yeah. So for what Ryan has said, but cause yeah, like, cause there's a certain level of like, you know, like you'll be polite to somebody, you know, to their face or whatever, but like the, I guess like the gossip that happens behind people's back, I feel like is a lot worse. Like, and, you know, I've never lived outside of this area, so I don't know. I've only heard other people talk about like, you know, how, culture or how people interact and behave up north, especially like in regards to, I guess like, you know, interactions along race lines or whatever, but like I've been told that like up north, like it's a lot more stark. Like people are still like, or there's neighborhoods that are just like segregated, and like there's just like, nope, we don't go over there. They don't come over here. We're happy like that. And then like in the South, it was always more like, you know, people were mixed. And so like in public, you know, people had to interact and be together, but like everybody went home to their own places. And then that's where like they were, I guess, you know, and we like, it's people have continued to like, you know, when you're out in public, yeah, you don't say these things, you don't, but whatever. But when you get back home, like that's when people will say what they will.
Yeah. It's we're just breeding a generation, well, generation upon generation of catty bitches, essentially.
Yeah, and then when they're being called out for like, you know, what's going on, like, yeah, there's like what you were saying, like trying to find the most asinine loophole and then pulling at that thread and saying like, oh yeah, we found the, like, you know, like the flaw in your armor, and now we're going to, like, because, you know, like, I guess something about like needing to be right.
Yeah, it's this identity of themselves that they hold that is, I mean, it's entirely a pride thing. And like, I get it. No, I don't. I don't get it at all. I thought I did, but I mean, like, these people, I guarantee you most of these families didn't have roots in the Confederacy. Their great grandfathers are probably from like Eastern Europe or some shit, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's a way that it, this might be a dumb way to say it, but it feels less like an identity than a way to identify, because they're searching for something.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's probably more basic than that. It's probably more animalistic, less thoughtful. I mean, they just have to have something to belong to, and, you know, big trucks and no black friends is one of, you know, the groups that accepted them.
Right. And I don't know, yeah, like, and also going back to, I guess, like when you were saying about, like, you know, being in high school and sort of like being aware of, like, you know, like the racist connotations, but just like, you know, like, I guess not seeing the way that the ripple effect. That,
yeah, I didn't see the consequences of it.
Like, I totally get that, because, like, yeah, like back when I was in high school, like, you know, one of my favorite, you know, sites on the internet was, you know, wasting time on 4chan.
Yeah.
Like, then, like, you know, going back through like the folder of images I've collected, I was like, wow, like, I don't like, this isn't funny anymore. Like, yeah. I know why I saved this, but now I'm not that person anymore. I've like seen a lot more and made a lot more connections. And so, yeah, like I've got to say, like, I certainly identify with what you were saying there.
That's a great damn way to put it. Made a lot more connections. That means a lot to me. That's excellent, because, like, you know, when we were all teenagers, we made jokes that we thought, it's why there is a subreddit called I am 14 or I'm 14 and this is funny, you know, and like, because teenagers are insular, they're isolated. They think that offense is funny, and that's because they just haven't met enough people. They haven't had the experience of dealing with people who aren't like them. They haven't forged, again, the connection. That's great. I like that a lot. I want to remember that.
And, like, I guess, like, one of the things that, like, or when I started to realize that that shift or change was happening was, like, because, you know, again, going back to, like, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, like, you know, I don't feel like, you know, somebody is less than me because of the color of their skin or anything. Like, you know, it's like I was, you know, taught or raised to believe that, yeah, like, you know, people are people, and we need to respect them. And so, yeah, then, like, I see something that's like making a racist joke, and I was like, oh, that's funny. Like, not true, but like, I it's a funny joke. And then, like, like, but yeah, like, so I would, you know, like, share that or whatever. And like, you know, because I thought like, well, you know, everybody's in on the joke, like that this isn't true, but we see why it's funny. But then like I started bumping into people who like were racist and were laughing at things for, I guess, like, you know, the wrong reason or like exposing to me like the like how, I guess, like the other interpretations. And anyways, like that's like when I started realizing like some of these people that are finding this funny aren't people that I enjoy associating with. And mm-hmm. then that really started me questioning like, yeah, like, am I really spending my time somewhere where, you know, that's productive?
Yeah, I totally get that. Like, it's hard when you realize that it's like the Chris Rock joke that he can't tell anymore. That like there's a difference between a black man and, you know, the N-word.
Right.
And he was saying that to be ironic, because that's how, you know, shitty white people view black culture, which, you know, obviously is like not a singular thing, black culture. But and then white people of that ilk started using that joke as an example, like, yeah, see, it's true. It's true. There are two kinds. And he was like, that's not at all what I meant.
Yeah, use that as a justification.
Yeah. That's, ugh. God, it's horrible.
And it's weird because, like, I feel like, you know, like, my I've carefully, I guess, like, you know, like, got the group of people that I hang out with, like, you know, like, I feel like is a very, to use the word, I guess, you know, progressive or open-minded, you know, group of folks. Like, you know, we all seem to you know, be, I guess, on you know, the right side of history or whatever on a lot of these topics or you know, current issues that are going on. But like I tend to forget sometimes that there is that vast amount of people who are like, you know, the other side of the, you know, opinions. And like with the whole like down in Mobile, like, you know, I think it was like 20,000 people or something like that showed up for you know, Trump. And that's just like mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's scary. It's scary shit is what it is.
Like there's an image that somebody was sharing, and it's just like this mother holding forth her baby so that, you know, Trump can kiss it, and everybody, like the mother and the father, just like have this look of extreme excitement, but the baby looks very uncertain about what's going on. And then like somebody added like the image to like a caption or text to the image saying like God of anger, please accept my sacrifice.
That is great. He is a God of anger. You know what scares me? What scares me is like, okay, so I get what they were trying to do, but the New York Times posted an article about how Trump was right on economic policy for like one point or something like that. Like, I understand that, like, because economics is a science, and scientifically speaking, he might have been correct. I don't know. I assume that the economist who wrote that article knows more than I do. I just don't believe that article should have been written or published, because the man is so deranged and dangerous that anything praising him, even in the context of look how wrong he is at everything else, is damaging.
Yeah, like I think that it's like a joke that got out of hand. Like people was like originally, it's like, oh, well, let's give him a little bit of airtime. And then like it wasn't supposed to work this well.
Yeah, exactly. It's insane. It's insanity.
There's a BBC show I watched a little while back called Black Mirror. Have you seen any of that?
I've seen a couple episodes. I saw the one with the you know, the recorders in your eyes and stuff.
Oh yeah. Well, like there's one.
It's actually the only one I've seen.
Okay. Well, there's one that deals with like, you know, politics. And,
is that the one where they make the president fuck the pig?
No. Okay. That's another one though. This one is, it's like a late night talk show or whatever. Like they have like a animated character that the host interacts with. And so they decide, well, let's have this animated character run for prime minister. And then like he ends up becoming like a serious candidate that got, and then like the network works out this deal to where like they can actually have this 3D animated character appear at the debates. And, but like, rather than debating like the other candidates, it's just like, you know, like flips off everybody and just like, you know, like does nonsensical things. And it ends up getting like, you know, affecting the political process in a major way that they were not expecting. Mm. And yeah, just like the unforeseen consequences of somebody's PR stunt.
I'll have to watch that one. That sounds really good. That sounds really good. Did you see it's going to become a Netflix show?
Oh, Mirror Black is?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, Netflix picked it up to continue it. Shit, what was I going to say? But getting back, I guess, to the Vestavia thing, there's
right.
You know, that advocates for positive change is still alive and well, apparently, in Vestavia. They invited me to be part of their, like, you know, secret Facebook group. But honestly, I think their main goal was just, you know, getting rid of the mascot, which we did. We got rid of the mascot and we kept the name Rebels, which I'm fine with. That's literally all I could have hoped for. I didn't expect any more than that. Because Rebels itself does not carry any racist connotations. It will for a while at Vestavia, simply because we know where it came from, which was literally white flight. But, you know, it's a step in the right direction. But this Advocates for Positive Change, they're sort of floundering now because, you know, they don't have the direction.
Yeah, like a short-term goal to...
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I guess they have a long-term goal, which is making everything wonderful. But, like, you know, how do you do that? I don't know. It's that Vestavia is such a weird place. It's a strange, strange place to grow up. It was very boring and racist. And I guess why I wanted to bring it up was sort of to tie back in to what we were talking about earlier with the mindset of the South in general. Was, you know, you take your problems home with you and then bitch about them there.
Yeah.
I do believe that. In general, everything has gotten better since the 60s and since like the civil rights movement. And I'm only talking about Birmingham here because, you know, black people are now allowed to go everywhere with the, you know, they want, you know, not de facto, but the writ of the law says that they are. And I do feel that to a small degree, people are less racist in Birmingham. I don't think that has much to do with, like, the legal aspect. I think it has to do with the media aspect and the fact that, like, we, you know, as kids, you and I had that programming I was talking about earlier where we see the diversity ads and stuff like that. And I think that's a huge impact on kids. But I think that in some ways it might actually still be worse because now it has to stay indoors.
Mm-hmm.
It festers there, like, and not only because of the, as Ryan put it, the us versus them mindset, not only because that mixed with the Southern pride is going to make it a sore issue that they keep talking about, and they have to keep talking about it in secret, which is, you know, it's just a feedback loop at that point.
Right.
You also now can't just tell. It's like the difference between the North and the South, like we were talking about earlier. You can't just tell who's a racist and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
And like, have you ever been with anybody, like just been hanging out with somebody, and you can just kind of tell that they're saying something to kind of throw out a feeler to see if you kind of feel that way? Like maybe you also don't like those people.
Yeah, I've been in those situations.
Nothing so blatant, but like, you know, they make a joke that is clearly a censored form of the joke that, you know, they want to make or something like that. You mm-hmm. know, I feel like that is a perfect illustration of the South right now, or at least Birmingham. So is it better? Yes, but not enough, I guess is what I want to say.
Yeah, like, or you know, the old saying, it was like, you know, it's like, I guess, you know, things get worse, or it's dark before dawn. It's the darkest before dawn. Like, you know, like things are, yeah, like you said, on paper or in certain aspects, they're better. But you know, we still have to, we have to you know, pull the bandages off and clean the wound out. And, yeah. and redress it. Like, we can't just put a Band-Aid on it and say, like, yeah, that's gonna heal up just fine.
How did you feel? I think, I mean, it's getting really late here. I've still got work to do, so we need to wrap this up in a bit, but I wanna I'd love to do another one of these, by the way, too.
Awesome.
But and I'll put you in touch with people in Chattanooga too, because I think that there's a shitload of interesting people here in this city. It's a tiny city full of weird ass people that are really great.
Sounds familiar.
Right. But I wanted to ask you what you thought about the Glenn Beck rally.
That was pretty upsetting.
Right? Like, oh my god.
It felt like I heard something about that months ago, and then it just sort of like, you know, I brushed off my shoulder, and then like I saw a post of like right after it happened, and like I'd forgotten that I had heard about it before, so it was just like out of nowhere, just blindsided by this. And then, yeah, like huge turnout, and like I immediately, like, you know, like knew something was amiss, because it's like I felt like I'm pretty connected in most like activist stuff like going on in the Birmingham area, and like the fact that I didn't hear about that, I was like, well, this doesn't sound right. And then, yeah, like I looked in it, I was like, oh gosh, yeah, like Glenn Beck, like he's behind it.
It's such bullshit, man. It's minstrelsy. They're using black people for entertainment.
Yeah. Like totally co-opting, yeah, like these communities and like, you know, roping them in into this parade.
Yeah, and like it's like not only is it like their entertainment and that they're being, you know, I suppose, to use the word loosely, intellectually jerked off by the fact that like these black people are like supporting their cause, you know, their Christian cause for the people in the Middle East. But it's also like, it's literally watching song and dance. Mm-hmm. It's almost literally a minstrel show, because there's that quote from the Al.com article where like John Voight says some shit like, I've always felt a connection with gospel music. I've never seen it live, but I'm watching it now, and I just want to get up on stage. And Glenn Beck puts his hand on John Voight's shoulders and said, go.
Oh, man.
It's literally a quote from the article. And I'm just like, oh my God. Oh my God.
Yep, these people are out there.
They're out there, and they're influential.
Why, gotta keep talking.
Yeah. To as many people as possible, right?
Mm-hmm. And I feel like since like this most recent sort of like, yeah, like outburst of conversation and you know, like, and at, you know, political action, like, I feel like it is becoming more of a, or at least, again, like within my circle, like it is becoming more of a, you know, common talking point, and like people talking about, like, I guess feeling more confident about, like, you know, speaking their opinion and not like, you know, caring what the other people are around are going to feel or say, or like, cause like, I think like, especially like, yeah, within our generation, like we're beginning to realize that, like, you know, we like, you know, this opinion, it may still be in the minority, but it's a large enough minority that it still has to be recognized, and mm-hmm. and there's a certain strength in numbers. And so, yeah, like, you know, you can be out and have a conversation and like you know, like may get some glances from people who you can tell like aren't happy about what you're saying, but then there's like other people who like you can notice that like they're listening to what you're saying because they're interested in that conversation.
Do you know, I agree with that part entirely, but I'm not sure that we're really a minority. I think it goes back to like that principle from, you know, Goldwater and Nixon, the silent majority.
Right.
I think most people in this country, like, maybe they don't give as much of a shit about things as we do, but they also just, to use the phrase differently, they don't give a shit. Like, it's fine. Whatever. I don't care if the gay people get married. Like, it really sucks that black people are getting shot by cops, and, like, I wish that would stop. But they're silent about it, which is not by any means a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is hopeful. It is a hopeful thought to maintain that, like, I really do believe that most people in this country are reasonable, if not active enough. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a much better way of phrasing that.
Because, like, I honestly don't know anybody, like even my super racist cousin, Daniel, like, I probably shouldn't have said that because he might listen to this.
I can cut it.
I don't care if you do. He needs to know. He, you know, he posts things like all lives matter and shit. And, like, you know, there's literally nobody in this country except for racists that don't believe that all lives matter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are racists that believe that black lives don't matter, you know, but they're literally the only people who don't actually subscribe to all lives matter. Mm-hmm. The people who are posting all lives matter are being racist by doing so because it's in reaction to black lives matter. Like, they're not protesting cops killing black people. They're protesting people posting Black Lives Matter. And, like, it's absurd. It is just an absurd thing for people not to accept that. And it's again, it cycles back around to what we were talking about. It's the pride, man. It's the, we don't believe we're wrong, and here you are telling us that, you know, we've been wrong all along.
Yeah, I think that's true, and you know, hopefully we can learn like to enjoy being wrong. Like there's a certain comfort in knowing that, yeah, like you can mess up. Like you're not, like your perceptions are not the what is the word, like, objective. You're only experiencing a very small slice of reality, and it takes communication with other viewpoints to develop a fuller image of you know what's going on.
Yeah, it's like you were saying, it's you've made more connections, and now you are a different person, and you realize that, like, these things aren't okay.
Right.
I really dig that. I think that's great. Yeah, it's this weird lack of, I use the word acceptance, not like of accepting other people. Oh, that's obviously weird too. It's this lack of like acceptance that they are wrong. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I literally dressed up as a Confederate slave owner for, you know, every week for 5 months, and I danced around for a stadium of like 5,000 people who cheered me on every week, right?
Yeah.
And like, I realized that that's not okay. Like, even, I mean, like, at the time, I also didn't, I just thought it was funny and ironic that I was doing it, but I would not do that now. That's simply unacceptable. Like, people need to change. People need to grow up.
like, I don't know, there's so much more like that we could like continue on this subject, and there's like other like, you know, tangents that I'd really like to go off on, but yeah, like you said, like it's an hour later for you than it is for me over here, and I've got a couple things that I need to do as well. Is there anything that you want to like throw out, like anything that you've got going on or that you know of going on that you want to like, you know, get the word out on?
Well, not that I can think of now. You mean just like events around Chattanooga or Birmingham?
Like, yeah, that or you know, anything that that, you know, you're planning on trying to get out to, or that, you know, maybe like somebody that you knows trying to put together. You know, just like I guess I typically try to wrap this up with the just like a real quick, like, you know, 1-2, like, you know, like something that people can try to look forward to.
Well, there is a Chattanooga Film Festival coming up real soon that I think people would probably enjoy, because Chattanooga's got a burgeoning local filmmaking scene, and it's also apparently quite a draw for some big name animators. Or, yeah, I think it's animators. I could be quite wrong. I am wrong about that. No, but it's some like subset of big name filmmakers or trying to be up and coming big name filmmakers come to the Chattanooga Film Festival for something, and it's coming up right now. If anybody wants to check that out. You know, honestly, Chattanooga is just such an active city that I would encourage anybody to come up on any given weekend, check out the local city scene newspaper, and you'll find something that you like, whether it's academic, touristy, or, you know, hell, drinking related. You know, like, something's always going on in this city, and I think that people basically all over the South need to pin Chattanooga as a destination for a weekend.
Sounds good. And then, you know, I've only been to Tennessee like for a moment here and there, and mostly for work, but, yeah, I'd like to come out there and check things out.
Yeah, man, you should come on up. I'll show you around.
Sounds good.
All right, well, we should definitely do this again, because I think there's a lot more that we could talk about.
Definitely.
All right, so I'll just talk to you soon then.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on, and I'll talk to you soon.
Bye. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. Later.
Okay, everyone. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Back to the Fire with the Nat Yonts. Once again, I encourage you to check out the show notes and, you know, check out Nat's SoundCloud so that you can hear what he's been up to recently. I really enjoyed this conversation that we had, and you know, it's like I felt like, well, yeah, with several of these, like I felt like the conversation could go on for hours, because that's just, there's so much to talk about that's interesting. But, you know, try to limit these things to around an hour or so that it's manageable and reasonable to listen to in a single sitting or two. So certainly look forward to having Nat back on the show in the future. As always, be sure to check out all the other interesting podcasts and shows and whatnot that's popping up over on monolithradio.com. We're, you know, still growing, still, you know, putting down roots and establishing ourselves. The studio is finally coming together. I got to check that out not too long ago, and yeah, like, looks like a legit professional studio with, you know, all that, like, egg crate reverberation dampening stuff on the walls. I'm you know, obviously that's not my area of expertise, so I don't know the correct terminology to describe those, but I bet Nat would. So yeah, stay tuned for all the cool stuff coming out there. Let me know what you think of the show. If you've got any issue with anything that I've said, shoot me a line and say why. If there's a topic you think I ought to cover or a particular guest you think would be good for me to have on again, send me a message. I really want to hear what you have to say. If you are listening to this before October the 1st, then try to check me out at the upcoming Birmingham Art Crawl. If this is after October the 1st, then try to check me out at a future art crawl. They're the first Thursday of the month up in Birmingham off of 2nd Avenue North. I'm not going to be at all of them, but I try to make it out to a couple of them. And even if I'm not there, there's plenty of other interesting local artists for you to see as well. So, try and do that and, support the scene if you've got the ability to do so. There's probably a couple of other little notes that I could throw in, but off the top of my head, I'm not really able to think of any. So I think I'm just gonna leave it here this time. I hope you've enjoyed, and be looking forward to another episode in 2 weeks from now. Until then, be well.